Mr. Sheldon, good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you so much for calling me, calling this case first.
Certainly.
We really appreciate it.
Certainly. Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
Okay. And we won't interrupt you. You'll have to keep track of that. But let me just make sure Judge Alston's set to go here, and then you're all set. Okay. Whenever you'd like
Thank
to
you.
Begin, sir.
Sure. Dr. Rosanna was an optometrist at Vision Works. He had done 25,000 to 30,000 eye exams when a Miss Ivers came into Vision Works. She had an exam, and after her exam, she complained to the police that she had been inappropriately touched. In response to Ivers' complaint, the police initiated a social media campaign to find out if anybody else was, quote, may have been inappropriately touched. After months of this dragnet, finding out if anybody else may have been inappropriately touched, the Commonwealth came up with two other witnesses, a Ms. Lopez and a Ms. Emery, and Dr. Rosanna was charged with sexual battery of more than one person in less than a two-year period. Lopez complained that during her eye exam, Dr. Rosanna's knee touched the inside of her thigh and approached to his groin. Emery complained that during the eye exam, his hand went down to her, quote, flank, and as she had to turn for the eye exam, he turned her with his hand on her flank. Ivers had a more involved complaint, and none of our two issues involve Ivers. But the jury had to find that Dr. Rosanna had sexually assaulted two people, and our two assignments of error are regarding the facts of Lopez and Emery.
Well, let me ask you about that, Mr. Sheldon.
Yes.
Your contention is with Lopez that it was not sexual abuse because he did not force her to touch his private parts.
Exactly.
And do you contest then that he sexually abused Emery as well?
No, we don't.
I mean, for purposes of the assignment of error, right?
Well, for purposes of the assignment of error, what we're saying is we don't know what the jury found. And in fact, the prosecution explicitly argued you don't have to find all three. You just have to find two. So if you don't find one of these, the prosecutor argued, that's okay, you only have to find two. And our problem is we don't know what the jury found. And because clearly, Dr. Rosanna did not force Lopez to touch him. It was incidental. That an invalid theory went to the jury.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So the word forces, the state wants this court to read the word forces out of the statute. The word force occurs in the statute at one point, and that's not what we're contesting. And then later in the statute, there's an intentional touching. That's not what we're contesting. We are contesting the part where the statute says that a defendant forces a victim to touch them. And the word forces must mean something more than a touching.
What's the significance in subsection 2, which is where the conviction occurred, of the omission of the word by force and just the words with consent if it's more than one person?
Right. So the way that it would be logical, since we have to read the statute as a whole, would be to say that if Dr. Rosanna touches or the defendant touches somebody, then that's sufficient. Force is not required. But where the word force is applied only in a certain kind of touching, what kind? When the defendant forces the victim to touch them, that's when it applies. So it would be most logical to say, well, the word forces is omitted when a defendant touches a victim, but it applies when the victim touches the defendant. And it's both logical and it would satisfy the General Assembly's intent by including the word forces. And, of course, the word forces is only used in the statute when the victim touches the defendant. Could it have been articulated better? Many of these statutes, of course, can be, but it is the most logical reading of the statute, that when it's only one victim, of course, and you're going under subsection 1, force is always needed. When it's two victims, we have force not needed unless it is the victim touching the defendant. And then force comes into play again. And that's our argument with Lopez. I'd like to move to my second assignment of error, where the evidence was insufficient to show that Dr. Rosanna had a specific intent to sexually arouse, molest, or gratify. Now, the testimony of Lopez and Emery were both of incidental touching. Neither of them testified at all to any facts of any kind of sexual nature at all.
Isn't that the nature of why the statute is constructed in the conjunctive? Because that can suggest circumstantial circumstances, I guess, which would suggest that this was indeed intended to sexually arouse or gratify or whatever.
Well, I think, you know, what I'd like to analogize this to is your indecent exposure cases, because I just haven't found any reasonable cases under this statute that talks about the intent, the sexual intent. Your indecent exposure cases, you have so many of them, and in addition, they require, when you do the exposure, and sexual intent. And in your indecent exposure cases, you again and again say the exposure, and the analogy to here would be the touching, the exposure is not enough. There has to be a sexual intent to the exposure. When a woman exposes her breasts to an 11 and a 12-year-old boy, that is not indecent exposure unless there is a sexual element. In the exposure of the breast case, which is Nice v. Commonwealth, this court said, as a matter of law, the woman's exposure of her breast to the 11 and 12-year-old and joking to them that they could suck on her breast was, as a matter of law, not indecent exposure, because it was done in a joking manner and the defendant did not exhibit signs of sexual interest. In the case of A.M. versus Commonwealth, it was a boy, a 12-year-old boy, got off a bus, dropped his pants, and showed his butt to the bus driver. He was convicted of indecent exposure. And this court overturned, said, as a matter of law, insufficient evidence to show that there was any sexual interest at all. There was nothing in the record suggested the defendant
in
invited...
In that case, and I think I was on the panel that decided that case, there was a suggestion that this was just horseplay or silliness or whatever.
Exactly.
What evidence can you offer here to in any way connote what the good doctor apparently did with any type of horseplay?
Right. So that one was horseplay. We have other cases I can discuss which there was no horseplay, but the horseplay wasn't the key. The key was there was a reason other than sex of why he might have dropped his pants, and there was no evidence at all of sexual intent, right? So we have two of them together.
What's the significance, if any, of the fact that he does not say to the jury any contact was incidental? I contacted them, but it was accidental, did not mean to. He says, never happened. What can they infer from that?
Judge, you're right, but he says two things. He clearly says, I don't remember. He says, I don't remember the specifics of this. And he says, as most defendants do, never happened because he doesn't think it happened. But he does say at the beginning of his testimony, when he talks specifically about Lopez and specifically about Emery, don't remember these exams, but that's not what I do. So I think reading it fairly, you can more fairly read it as he doesn't remember them. And, you know, whether it's incidental or as he had testified, I didn't do it because he doesn't remember doing it, I think that would be more fair. But I think, Judge Alston, to get back to your point, I think the key to your finding as a matter of law no sexual intent in your indecent exposure cases were two things. There was no evidence of sexual interest, and there was another explanation for it. In the woman with the breasts, she was teasing the kids. In the mooning, it was the horseplay, and everybody knows what a mooning is. It's not sexual, it's mooning somebody. And in the nightgown case, in Romick, where this homeless guy's living in his car, he's in the nightgown, the cop asks him to move, and he lifts up his nightgown and moves to the front seat and exposes his genitals. He's convicted, and this court says it's a matter of law. It's a matter of law, because there was a reason why his nightgown was lifted, and that was to move to the front seat. Here, there is obviously a reason why somebody might touch. I mean,
I can understand the context of an examination by a doctor. There can be some invasion of a person's personal privacy or personal space, but at least in one of the cases, your client said something to the effect, after the victim there felt uncomfortable, he said something like, you don't look your age.
Yes.
One might consider that to be a suggestion of a sexual intent. You know, people, men and women, say all kinds of things to sort of set the stage for some sort of sexual encounter. And the fact finder could decide, based upon that statement alone, that there wasn't just a little bit of a touching or just a little bit of something that was benign in nature, but rather the doctor was doing something that was indeed intended to bring a sexual circumstance into the case.
I'd just like to answer that question before I leave the rest of my time for a moment. I think three things. First is Lopez clearly testified she did not take that comment as sexual in any way, and she testified to that. Second, the Commonwealth, in their closing, did not point to that remark at all, never characterized it in that way. Third, and I think most amusing, is when the Commonwealth called her as a witness and said, "How old are you?" She said, "I'm 63. And he says, "I wouldn't have guessed that."
Yeah,
the prosecutor during trial made the exact same comment.
But he wasn't in her personal space at that point, and he didn't have his knee in her groin area or anything like that.
It's true, but Lopez did not take that comment as sexual. She testified to that. The prosecution never characterized it as sexual. And, of course, the prosecutor made the exact same comment during trial. And if I don't think that comment arises enough to find sexual intent, and I'll leave the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. The trial court did not err in convicting the defendant of misdemeanor sexual battery in this case. I'd like to take the issues before the court out of order a little bit and speak to the intent issue first. As the court has mentioned here today, the Commonwealth was only required to prove that the defendant's criminal actions as to two of these three witnesses. The defendant here tonight today has not challenged the Commonwealth's third witness, which is Ivers, so the only two victims that are being challenged are Lopez and Emery. If the intent was there with Emery, we don't have to reach the force issue in Lopez because we are only dealing with two victims that are required for a conviction under this code section, if that makes sense. So this is going to the Commonwealth's harmless error argument. So speaking to the intent issue before the court today, that the jury heard enough evidence in this case to prove that the defendant was acting with the intent.
And responding to your opponent colleague's argument, what evidence would you point to suggest that there was any sexual gratification on the part of the doctor based upon the touching that he engaged in with the ladies?
Sure, Your Honor. I would note significantly that intent in many cases has to be shown by circumstantial evidence. We have to look at the defendant's actions and the context of those actions. The defendant here, in his own testimony and also in his expert witness's testimony, testified that there was no reason ever to contact a patient during these eye exams. His own expert used the word impossible. In light of that evidence, the jury was entitled to use its common sense. It was instructed both in the opening and in the closing at Appendix 44, and then also at 331, that the jury was entitled to use its common sense in this setting.
And the jury was indeed entitled to use its common sense. And when I read this case, and it's an unusual case, I thought about the contact that I have with my eye doctor, and my eye doctor's a female, and what she typically does is roll around in that little chair, grabbing my face and putting things up there, and I don't, you know, it's nothing sexual in nature about it, but I sort of question the expert witness's statement that this can never happen where you're actually touching, because I look back on my own personal experience, and she was in my space, and she was touching me. I don't think she was doing anything wrong, but she was in my space. What would you say in response to that?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that that's not the testimony in this case, but the touching that Your Honor is describing is kind of what you may think of as incidental with an eye exam. We're looking at your eyes. Mm-hmm. Presumably, your eye doctor has never, quote, cupped your buttocks, excuse me for my impudence. These are the kind of touchings that are not associated with an eye exam. We have the defendant forcing the victim's knee into his groin for a period of 6 minutes, adjusting his chair up and down so that contact continues. We have the cupping of the buttocks, which are both groin and buttocks are...
The genesis of this statute actually came from a case in Prince William County where a doctor was making women disrobe for sprained ankles. Mm-hmm. And the way that the government in that case proved its case is by bringing in several other people who had experienced similar circumstances and having a doctor come in and testify that this type of touching should not happen. So are you of the view that the reason why the statute is written in the conjunctive is because of the circumstantial nature of any case that the Commonwealth needs to prove, unless the defendant in the case actually says, I was doing that to become sexually aroused or whatever?
Sure. I think that's a reasonable explanation for it. But again, in any case that we're dealing with intent, I mean, sometimes defendants sign confessions, sometimes they say things there, but it's not necessary for the defendant to expressly admit his intent. And certainly in this case, the jury had the ability to watch the defendant testify on the stand as he denied any contact whatsoever with these victims, or in the alternative, failed to recall any contact whatsoever with these victims. Look at his demeanor while he said that. And, of course, we're dealing with a cold record here, but that person was present in front of the jury, and they could compare the demeanor of the witnesses in this case with the defendant's demeanor and conclude that either he was lying to conceal his guilt or just simply find the witnesses were more credible in a case where the defendant had, by his own admission, no reason for any physical contact whatsoever. These victims were very clear in their testimony as to what happened, and that denial certainly weighs is something for the jury to weigh in determining the credibility of the defendant in this case. So for those reasons, especially since we're dealing with a factual issue, intent is a factual issue, and it's entitled to the highest level of appellate deference, and there is simply no reason to touch a stranger on any of these intimate parts in or outside the context of an eye exam here.
I think that what your opponent and colleague is suggesting is that this case isn't necessarily a case dealing with the standard of review. Rather, it deals with whether or not the actions that the defendant is alleged to have engaged in fit within the confines of the statute. I don't think he's got any problem with the standard of review. He's basically saying that the defendant's actions don't meet the statements in the statute. What would be your response to that?
I disagree, Your Honor. I think this is a standard of review case because these are fact findings by the trial court, by the jury in this case. And when we have to look at those determinations in that light, and when the defendant is saying these are incidental touchings, and that's simply not a reading of the record that is in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, or frankly, it contradicts his own testimony that there could never be this kind of incidental contact. This record, when viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, as this court is entitled to do, or is required to do, frankly, demonstrates that this was not incidental touching, and that was for the jury to decide.
But even with that analysis, and I appreciate your response, but even with that analysis, if we take, say, a standard assault and battery case, just a regular assault and battery case, and a person who doesn't know another person is simply walking down the corridors of the courthouse, and they accidentally bump into someone, don't know them, don't have any relationship, they just sort of brush each other. Technically, that's an assault. But you got to look at the facts and circumstances of the case. And a jury could find that individual guilty, where I believe any reasonable mind or any reasonable jurist on an appellate review would say, no, that doesn't fit the definition in the statute. So therefore, even though the jury finds that the defendant was guilty, we're going to give great deference to that determination. It just doesn't fit within the statute.
Yes, and Your Honor would be talking about a case where we have a plainly wrong or without evidence to support it type of standard. And this is not a case where there was no evidence in the record to support the fact that these touchings were with the proper intent. And I meant to address this sooner, but the indecent exposure cases that are cited by counsel are easily distinguishable because there the defendant has to be doing an obscene display. The word obscene is something that this court has defined on multiple occasions. It is something different than the intent in this case. And if the General Assembly meant to import that obscene intent into this code section, it certainly could have done so. We have a different intent that we're working with here, even if we are looking at that the sexually aroused, molest, or gratify. I think it's also significant that it's sexually aroused, molest, or gratify any person. So whether the victims took these touchings or took the comments that Your Honor, Judge Alston was speaking to earlier as being sexual in nature is not the point. The point is whether it was the defendant's intent to do these things. And the jury was also entitled to consider his statements to her in that light. So for all those reasons, I think that the obscene display cases are not analogous to the facts at issue here. And I think Again, using your common sense, the jury heard what happened in a normal eye exam. The jury heard testimony from the defendant and from the expert, what's supposed to happen during an eye exam. These were touchings that were outside the course of a normal eye exam, and there is simply no reason for an adult man in the context of this eye exam to be touching a patient on their buttocks, is the term that was used by the victim, on their groin, or with regard to the third victim, her breast, her vagina, et cetera. So they're simply not touchings that occur in the context of an eye exam. And using your common sense, the jury could infer that there was no other reason to touch the intimate parts of a complete stranger in a medical setting. When, again, as the court has noted, we're talking about an eye exam. This isn't a physical or any other kind of medical procedure where you might expect incidental contact to other parts of your body. So for all of those reasons, I would submit that the intent element is satisfied with respect to Emery and then also to Ivers. Ivers is not being challenged. And under those circumstances, the jury was entitled to find that the defendant did sexually batter two or more of these women within that two-year time period. So we don't have to get to the issue of force in Lopez. But turning to that issue, unless the court has further questions, I'm happy to stay here. So turning to that force issue, the Commonwealth's position is that the Commonwealth did not have to prove the same type of force that we normally see in sexual offenses, the force that would be required under the first subsection when we're talking about force, threat, or intimidation. This code section was recently enacted. It's enacted in 2014. It is the only one of those sexual offenses that does not have force as a stated element of the offense. And so when this court looks at the case law to this point, talking about Martin, the Supreme Court, et cetera, Wachter, all those cases are very clear that the element of force is the same throughout all these code sections. Well, we're dealing with an aberration here. And it is not unreasonable that the General Assembly, knowing the law as it exists, and particularly looking at this court's opinion in Johnson, where it said intentional non-consensual touching was not sufficient, when they then go and draft a statute that says exactly that, that intentional non-consenting touching is sufficient. And we have to look at that as a change in the law, and the court recognized the General Assembly is familiar with its case law to this point. It's reasonable under the circumstances because we're dealing with repeated incidents of lesser conduct as opposed to a single isolated incident in sub 1. To import a force element into this second subsection would also, frankly, eliminate the distinction between 1 and 2, because the defendant would be guilty of one misdemeanor, whether he sexually battered one or multiple women. There needs to be a lesser standard in order to affect the intent of the General Assembly with regard to that sub 2. Even if the court disagrees with that analysis, moreover, there was evidence of force in this case with regard to Lopez. And Lopez, again, is the victim who is seated in the chair, the chair which the defendant testified he could not move. It was a heavy chair, and she had that eye apparatus in front of her face while the defendant was leaning over her and positioned his knees and her knees so that her knee was repeatedly contacting his groin.
So you would rely on some of the language in the Davis case, which says the degree of force required to overcome the victim's will depends on the circumstances of each case. Relevant circumstances determine whether the victim's will has been overcome include the time and place of the crime, the victim's reaction during and after the incident, and the party's relationship and their relative physical capabilities. You would pluck some of the criteria that in the Davis case and apply it here.
Yes, Your Honor, and that language has been repeated by this court in subsequent and previous cases, talking about it's essentially a totality of the circumstances analysis when you're looking at what kind of force is necessary to overcome a victim's will there. And we do have significant circumstances here, such as, you know, the victim may not have been physically helpless as she was walking around, but while she is seated in that chair that is immovable with a piece of heavy machinery in front of her face, and the defendant is blocking her into that situation, she is helpless in that moment there. And in addition, that we have the defendant's repeated contact. We have him adjusting his chair. This happened for 6 minutes. This is not the situation that the court faced in Wilson, where a colleague grabbed another colleague's butt at the vending machine, you know, once so hard that she stepped forward. I would disagree that. I think I disagree with the outcome of that case, but nevertheless, you know, that's an isolated touching. That is touching that is not more, the court held, or rather there was no extra force involved there. The only force used was the force used to require that touching. In this case, again, we have prolonged contact. We don't have one isolated contact. We have 6 minutes. We have him blocking her into the chair, and we have him adjusting his chair up and down. This court has held use of force in similar cases, such as the Davis case, you know, where the victim is being pushed onto the bed, or in other cases where a victim is pushed down a hall. And those are any use of force over and above that to accomplish the sexual contact is sufficient in the force context, if you want to look at force generally in that regard. So summing up, I think there are a couple of ways that the court could go with this. The Commonwealth would submit that we didn't have to prove force as you normally do in, you know, a rape prosecution or in a prosecution under sub 1. But even if we did, the Commonwealth has met that burden with regard to Lopez. And if not, Emery and Ivers both have the evidence was sufficient with regard to both Emery and Ivers. Ivers' testimony is not being challenged here today, and the evidence was sufficient for Emery to show the defendant's intent was to sexually arouse, molest, or gratify during that prolonged contact with the defendant's groin, which, again, is a sexual organ as defined by the kids section. Okay. Be happy to answer, well, very quickly, in 30 seconds that remain, if the court has further questions.
Nothing further.
Thank you. I'd ask you that you affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Sheldon, hang on just 1 second. Let me let Judge Alston finish. But come on up, and then you've got about 4.5 minutes, sir.
Giving it to someone who knows what they're doing. I'm ready.
You ready? Okay. Whenever suits you, sir.
Okay.
Counsel, I was listening to your opponent colleague's argument, and what she's suggesting with regard to the first argument that you have is that essentially the old adage, a person intends the natural probable consequences of their act. That's essentially what I hear her saying, and that there are cases out there that uphold that in the context of a circumstance such as this. What would be your response to that?
The statute uses the word force. The word force must have meaning. This court has defined the word force, and the court has said, has defined it logically as it has the meaning of requiring more action than would be required to do the basic act. So if there is a touch, then the touch has to have something more than a touch because the word force is used. And you can't just read the word force out of the statute.
And so if we segue from that to the second component of the argument, she's suggesting that there are facts and circumstances in this case to indicate force, and I would suggest that she's probably relying on the fact that the party's relationship, he's a doctor, she's a patient, and so that she's in a vulnerable position, number one, and the time and place of the crime, that's what the case says. She's in a doctor's office, if they're doing an eye exam, it's dark, it's a situation where she is uncomfortable, and so therefore that satisfies that particular predicate in the statute. What would be your response?
I think the other factors, of course, weigh against the finding of force. And this is nothing like any of the cases in which this court has found force. This court has found force when somebody was forced to touch somebody, and the defendant was a 45-year-old man, and the victim was a minor. This court has found force when the victim has been forced to touch the defendant, when the victim was not competent. But in this case, you have two grown people during an eye exam. They're in two chairs separated by a machine. She can get up. She can say something at any time, including in Davis. One of the factors is, what did the person say at the time, and what did the person say afterwards? And what I had wanted to leave this court with, but I'll say it now, is you must look at the nature of how these witnesses came forward. They said nothing at the time. When they left, they said nothing to anybody else at VisionWorks. In the days afterwards, they said nothing to VisionWorks. They didn't call to complain. They didn't call the police.
But isn't that the response of several individuals who are the victims of sexual offenses? They sort of say, "What happened there?" They sort of reflect on the nature of the facts that occurred. And you also find that a lot in your, I guess, somewhat more serious cases of rape, where a victim won't come forward because she's embarrassed or she doesn't really understand what happened, and so there's this time of reflection before they decide that what happened to me wasn't right and I'm going to tell somebody.
Absolutely, Judge Olson. There are a myriad reasons why victims of sexual assault don't come forward that are very valid. And we see that in the Catholic abuse church cases. We see that in rape cases. There's valid reasons. But there are other reasons, and sometimes the reason is because you weren't sexually assaulted.
Yeah, benign.
And here, remember, they didn't come forward until they read a social media campaign that was months long that asked, have you been inappropriately touched, or may have you been inappropriately touched? Then they came forward. Remember, Dr. Rosanna has done 25 to 30,000 eye exams in this location. And after months of this social media campaign, what do we have? We have Lopez saying my knee touched his inner thigh up to his groin, and we have Emery saying, I was turned for the eye exam and his hand instead of on my back or somewhere was on my, quote, flank, and then later buttocks. And let me say, like, the one thing for sure is none of us will see eye exams the same anymore, right? Because I had an eye exam a month ago, and when I said to the doctor, your knee is touching the inner part of my thigh, he said, oh, and he pulled back. And
that's why it's not being prosecuted.
And nobody said anything to Dr. Rosanna right at the time. And if you have no other questions, I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Shelton.
Thank
we
you.
Will come down and greet counsel.
Thank you.